Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, your documentary offers a fly on the wall sort of perspective of the efforts of the tenants, the public housing tenants, to resist relocation. Can you tell us a little bit about the sort of history of Mills Point and what makes it special to these people?
Mills Point's got an incredibly rich history. The people who are still living in that area date back for many generations to the first colonists that came to Australia. It was a hub of working class people, people who built the city. You had the painters, dockers, wharfies, some of the people who are in the documentary worked on the wharves as young as 14. Their mothers worked in canteens around the wharves. Fathers went out to sea. It was a real hub of working class people.
So what was the kind of connection did you find from talking to residents that the people had with Miller's Point?
Miller's Point, to the people who'd lived there for generations, was a part of them. So when they walked the streets of Miller's Point, it was not only walking where they had grown up their entire lives, but generations, you know, two or three generations before them had walked. And from what I've heard, it was a very close-knit community from the early days right up until recently, because people didn't have much, but what they had, they shared around. So there's stories of up at the Abraham Watt Hall, which was the kind of community centre there, if a family couldn't pay their rent that week or they needed some extra money for food, people would go up and toss any coins that they had into a hat or a mat in the centre of it, and that family would take that money and be able to pay their rent. So it had really strong community ties, and it was about people helping each other.
In the doco, you got a lot of fly-on-the-wall footage. Now, I know one documentary maker who also made a film based in the Housing Commission area, and he was telling me how a lot of the residents were fearful that it was going to be a current affair-type beat-up thing, so they were originally quite resistant. How did you go about sort of gaining the trust of all the people involved in this struggle?
Look, I was very gentle and I was very upfront. I went to the very first community meeting that happened straight after the announcement, made myself known to who I thought would be kind of the people in charge, and just said, look, I'm here, I think this is interesting, if it's up to you if you want me to film or not. And it was just a case of respecting everything that they said, giving them space when they needed space, and just showing up at each event so they could see that I meant business. Like, I wasn't just in it for a quick story. I was there for the long haul because the story was so complex that I knew I needed a long time to tell it. I think also when people met me, they knew that I wasn't working for Channel 9 or 7 or a current affair. I had a tiny little dinky camera that I'd borrowed from a friend. You know, I was just there with my backpack and a big smile. So I had a very different approach, not only in kind of my ideas I wanted to put forward, but just kind of looking at me, they could tell that I wasn't a part of something big and fancy.
Okay, so in the doco, you showed the impact in particular on ageing residents, with probably the best example is this 90-year-old Myra Dimitru, who was the last person to be evicted from the Sirius building. Can you tell us a little bit about the impact that the forced relocation has had on, you know, on these old residents?
The impact that the move had on the more elderly residents of that area was something that was quite hard for me to deal with, in that I'd met people in 2014, and once they moved, I just saw with my own eyes this rapid degeneration of both their mental health, their physical health. It felt like every week somebody else was dying from being moved to a different place. And most of that was to do with them losing their day-to-day interactions, being able to get up and walk down the street, get the milk, come back, they've got some exercise that day. When people were moved, they lost those everyday interactions that made their lives better, and a lot of them started to vegetate. And when you lose the things around you that make life worth living, you know, it's much harder to keep going. So the ageing residents had a really big emotional impact on me. One of them in particular, Molly, who was 90 and a half when I met her, is now very, very unwell. And filming with her down the track was very emotional because I'd met somebody who was so interesting and bright and sharp as a tack, and, you know, a few years later was just, it was really hard to recognise that first person that I'd met.
How would it feel as the struggle continued? Was it heartbreaking to actually watch as the public momentum sort of started to wane away?
It was incredibly heartbreaking. I feel like I've been carrying this film around on a little knapsack on my shoulder for the last 4.5 years, just kind of begging people to pay attention and to care. The media in the beginning was, there was lots of attention, but so much of it was negative, and no one was really telling the core story, which was, you know, a government deciding that business was more important than people and acting accordingly. I've got to be honest, I didn't think that the community would lose. I thought that I would be making a film about the success of people uniting and fighting back. I think one of the big contrasts with the 70s and the Green Bands and today is that the laws are so different and so oppressive in a lot of ways that people can't protest like they used to. Unions can't strike like they used to. And I think it was those things that really made the protest in the 70s that Pat Fisk captured with Rocking the Foundation so effective. People said no, and people linked arms, and people got, you know, thrown into cars, and, you know, we had little old ladies sitting on roofs, you know, protesting these things. The difference today is that you just can't protest like that because the repercussions are so severe.
Do you also think it's a public apathy?
I think that's true, but I also think that we're facing a very sneaky, clever beast in that so much of these things happen behind closed doors. They get snuck in on a Friday afternoon at 4:30 when nobody, you know, will see it. Like, it's a very tricky opponent that we're up against. And I think public apathy is huge. I don't know what the answer to that is, because in Australia right now we have so many things to be upset about and we have so many things that we need to fix. So I think a big part of it is apathy, in terms of you look at the situation, you go, well, I can't fix this. I can't do anything. So when that kind of drives people's thinking, not much happens.
Do you think much has been learned from this struggle and how to counter this sort of thing? Because there certainly will be the temptation for developers to target other areas of public housing to quite lucrative locations, Glebe, Waterloo. Can you see this possibly, unfortunately, happening again in 5-10 years' time?
5-10 years' time, I can see this happening in 2 years' time, 3 years' time. You know, I bet that there's already major plans in way to sell a lot of the public housing in Glebe, Newtown, all those areas. Because what people don't understand who are in power is that you need public housing and you need a diverse city and you need all these things to make Sydney a great place to live.